why the Four Noble Truths are interesting. Sometimes you just hear them and they don't seem that interesting to me. I was talking about the whole quality of the Four Noble Truths and the truth, especially of interdependence, which is another book that I have that I'm going to be referring to called Paticca-samuppada, and this is by Bhikkhu, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu. And you can get this from overseas. You can get free copies of this from the corporate body of the Buddha. They make free copies of these and send them out, so you can lend it to you and you can check out to see the free copies or something. This is a series of writings that he did on examining the whole teaching of dependent origination. I know, but probably you've heard the words dependent origination once or twice. Have you? Mm-hmm. So what does it mean?
Everything arises dependent on everything.
Other things.
Everything. Nothing arises without causes and conditions.
Right. And causes and conditions also only arise dependent on
causes and conditions.
And so they come into being, they exist, and they pass away continuously. And that's basically the teaching of the dependent origination. Dependent origination is dependent on what came before and how it is impermanent and changing. And so what is present now is also impermanent and changing. I'm sure we've all noticed that to some degree. Mm. And yet we have this idea of a sense of self, don't we? Who I am and who you are.
Who
I don't do that.
Hurt?
Hmm?
Who can get hurt or be happy?
Yeah. You know, Linda sits on the footage you so many times. I wouldn't do that. I said, I'm not that kind of person. And then I did it, and I thought, geez, it's bad enough not knowing who you are. It's worse not knowing who you're not. And that kind of very straightforward, isn't it? But from moment to moment, that's not how we feel, is it? And yet we can watch ourselves go through different mind changes, can't we, in a day?
Mm-hmm.
And we know that each of them has quite a different motive, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And yet we get very caught in habitual patterns of a self, don't we?
For sure.
So according to the Buddhist teaching, that is the main cause of suffering. Believing in a fixed identity. Because then you can't accept change. And there is only change. There are three kinds of suffering. What are they?
Not getting what one wants. Getting what one doesn't want.
Not getting what one wants.
Yes.
Not what one wants, not lasting.
Oh, okay, yes, not lasting.
Yeah. So not getting what one wants is sort of like getting what one doesn't want, isn't it?
No.
Getting what one doesn't want is one, the suffering of dissatisfactoriness, of what you don't like, and the suffering of that the what you like is impermanent.
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed that? Just how long can you make an orgasm last? I mean, yeah, now you can get orgasms from eating something like coconut bliss or something. Even that has its end, doesn't it? How long can you make that happiness last? It's always about to dissolve or shift, isn't it? And the third one is the suffering of change. The suffering that nothing is dependable. Even the self isn't dependable. That there's continuous shifting and changing all the time. And that we don't like seeing that. And we don't like seeing it, do we? We will go to great, great lengths to stop looking at that there is no fixed identity. And all our defense just flies out the window if there's no self to defend. Doesn't it? You got a question, Gloria? Should I leave you to it for a while? So, there's lots of places to start this teaching, but I think I'll start on page 16, because we haven't started yet. That was just an intro. In the sutras, the Buddha stated several times that whoever perceives the interdependent nature of reality sees the Dharma. And whoever sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. Well, that's an interesting statement, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Pretty straightforward.
But then what is the Buddha?
That's right.
We find there are three levels of meaning here. First, the understanding of the principle of interdependent origination that is common to all Buddhist schools explains it in terms of causal dependence, dependent on causes, like you were saying. This principle means that all conditioned things and events in the universe come into being only as a result of the interaction of various causes and conditions. This is significant because it precludes two possibilities. One is that things can arise from nowhere, with no causes and conditions. And the second is that things can arise on account of a transcendental creator. Both these possibilities are negated. Because how does the transcendental creator arise? Secondly, we can understand the principle of dependent origination in terms of parts and whole. All material objects can be understood in terms of how the parts comprise the whole, and how the very idea of whole depends upon the existence of parts. When we talk about a self, we mean all the different selves that go through, don't we? And we actually believe that, you know, all those selves make a self. Such dependence clearly exists in the physical world. Okay, this is a book and it's made up of trees and, you know, ink and glue and factory workers and similarly, non-physical entities like consciousness can be considered in terms of their temporal sequences. The idea of their wholeness is based upon the successive sequences that compose a continuum. Successive sequences. How many different moments have arisen since we came up the stairs? Many, haven't there been? Mm-hmm. And yet there's this sense of one string of continuum of a self walking up the stairs, sitting down, prostrating or whatever. Isn't there? There's a continuum, but there isn't any. The idea of their wholeness is based upon the successive sequences that compose a continuum. So when we consider the universe in these terms,
Not only do we see each conditioned thing as dependently originated, we also understand that the entire phenomenal world arises according to the principle of dependent origination. There is a third dimension to the meaning of dependent origination, which is that all things and events, everything in fact, arise solely as a result of the mere coming together of many factors which make them up. When you analyze things by mentally breaking them down into the constitutive parts, you come to the understanding that it is simply in dependence upon other factors that anything comes into being. Therefore, there is nothing that has any independent or intrinsic identity of its own. Whatever identity we give things is contingent on the interaction between our perception and reality itself. Let me know if you want me to reread any sentence anytime.
So, does that mean reality itself is not dependent? The last sentence.
I don't think he's really addressing that here yet, but the thing that we're talking about here is that the interdependence on perception and reality. Mm-hmm. That it is real to you, but it isn't real to you 1 minute later, or to 20 other people in the room.
So there's no way of knowing if reality out there is changing, other than a theoretical supposition, because if everything is dependent on my perception of it, and that's always changing, and I know that my perception is not the same as anyone else's perception, because mm-hmm. that's all. All our perceptions are based on causes and conditions and patterns from the past.
Yeah. And there are some perceptions that we agree on.
Yes.
Like, for example, doing MRIs and scanning the brain. Mm-hmm. We will agree on this pattern means this or this pattern means that. Like, this pattern means that there's a cancer in the brain. This pattern means, right?
Yeah. But that doesn't, it's like, at some point in time, we all agreed that black people were devilish and they were harmful.
That's right.
And we don't agree on that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And that goes the same for, like, we agree that this is red and that this is purple.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's no way of knowing that what I'm seeing is the same as what you're seeing.
That's exactly right? True. Yeah. So it's the statement made is that there is no way to define reality.
Ah.
Or, like David Bohm said,
reality is the thing you think about.
R-E-S. Reality root is R-E-S. Thing root is R-E-S. Think root is R-E-S. All come from the Latin R-E-S. Hmm. That's fascinating to me.
And what is R-E-S?
It's either reality or think, depending on how you use it. Reality is the thing you think about. When he said that, it was like, oh, that freak shock went through. It isn't that it isn't there, it isn't that it mm-hmm. is there. Is there causes and conditions, and causes and conditions here meeting? Mm-hmm. And we agree on certain things, or you always, you know, eat your peas by not picking them up off the plate, you use your fork. You know?
Mm-hmm.
We have these certain conditions that we agree on. But that's relative truth. In relation to subject, there is an object. It's called relation, relative, because it's in relation to subject-object. That's what relative truth means. Relative truth does not negate absolute truth, nor does absolute truth negate relative truth. Buddhism is based on those two truths. Relative truth is for the practice of compassion. Absolute truth is for the understanding of wisdom.
What was that? Just a couple of words?
Relative truth is for the practice of compassion. In relation to a subject, there is an object. That's relative, in relation to. Absolute truth is transcending subject-object. It is an awareness that transcends duality. We would call it thou. If you didn't think thou was separate from I. And it's a good mantra. So absolute truth is for the realization of no inherent identity, period. No difference between samsara and nirvana, and no difference between nirvana and samsara. Absolute truth is realizing the awakening that has always been present. It's not anything you get, it's already there. But relative truth is how to operate in relation to. Which is the dance on the top of the absolute. Any other questions?
So if two people agree on something, it still doesn't make it right. It just makes it...
Two people agree. Well, they all stop at a red light, basically. I mean, I think more or less we all stop at a red light.
Yeah.
True?
Yeah.
That's like an agreement. But everybody would have a different experience to the red light. Some people, somebody who just dropped their lit cigarette and the light finally turned red just as they would be really grateful. They put their foot and looked to see whether it was burning up any of the garbage that it fell into, right?
Yeah.
Somebody else who was racing because their wife was about to give birth and they came up to the red light and they go, oh, is that true?
Yeah.
They're both stopping. It's a total different reality to both of them. Is it the same reality for both of them? They're stopping.
The stopping is the reality.
Also the fact that the one person wishes it wasn't red and the other person wishes that it was.
Yeah.
That's the reality too. The Buddha said, I too use concepts, but I'm not fooled thereby.
Okay.
Interesting idea, isn't it?
Yeah, I can follow that one.
It's one of my favorite of his quotes.
I too
use concepts, but I am not fooled thereby. So having the experience of absolute truth, then being able to work with it, relative truth, for compassion, period. Not for self-justification. Huge, huh?
See that last one again?
Imagine being able to have an experience that transcends subject-object duality, absolute truth, and then be back in this realm and being able to use subject-object duality for compassion, not for self-justification, not for holding up my view.
So the red light, for instance, then, we're all taught what a red light means and what you should do. It's a rule. We don't like it sometimes, we like it other times. So basically, the motive for the red light is so that we can get along without killing each other.
That's true. That's true. And we all more or less recognize that, especially if there's a big enough fine and a police car sitting there.
But we don't think of it really as a compassionate thing for the general populace, because our individual response to it is...
Well, some people might, and some people might not. I mean, it's possible that some people might.
Mm.
But to understand that the relative world is how we practice compassion.
Mm.
In relation to.
Go ahead, he says.
It's one of the things I noticed about Olivia, because she's only a year. And there are times when she's, you know, she's doing this and this, and, you know, and that's one. And then she just stopped.
Yeah.
And she's just there.
Yeah.
And then she goes and listens. And
yeah.
And it's like, and it's the first time I saw her, there was this. You know, all those kinds of things that people say about, oh, we come here to learn lessons or however.
Well, we do, in a way.
Yeah.
But it's not that straightforward. It's not like ABC.
Yes, exactly.
It's like very complicated. We fit into the circumstance we were born in.
Yeah.
There's a fit, or we don't stay there.
Yeah.
So I guess it's not my parents' fault either. It's all three of us.
Well,
it has to be a three-way agreement, is what I'm saying.
Because all the causes and conditions, not just in our society, are so vast, but then you think of all different types of societies that there are.
Yeah.
But the underlying reasons for opening the door and coming in the first place.
No, the Buddha said if you're looking for an original cause, you'll go mad unless you have an experience of the Absolute.
Yeah.
If you have an experience of the Absolute, then there's no problem being able to see the billions of causes and conditions dancing. Like watching the Milky Way through a telescope or something, and seeing the billions of stars interacting. But, you know, with a brain that's too busy trying to keep my sense of it, you're too busy trying to string certain things together and you make things fit because it feels right to you. And then somebody will insist that you pay attention to something that you don't want, so you can go, you could go mad, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, you don't go mad if you try to understand causes and conditions.
So because
without an experience of transcendence. Yeah?
So because the Buddha had seen it.
This teaching of the teachers on the Vada, on dependent origination, was how he realized. By looking at this teaching, by looking around and thinking, I really want to share this with other people. And he looked around and he's trying to find somebody that would be able to understand it. He couldn't see anybody. So then he's, wait a minute. Then he starts thinking about it and he said, well, you know, if we look at the dependent interdependence of everything, that would give people a clue. And then he formulated this teaching. And this is the first teaching he gave to the five monks that he went to. This is the first teaching, interdependent origination. And from this came all of the thousands of teachings of the Buddha. So what are you asking?
But that was after
his enlightenment. After he experienced transcendence, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And came back into name and form, but with a difference.
The difference was that he was on the other side.
He had transcended name and form and could still operate it within it. So he had both the wisdom and the compassion, what you call the wisdom of emptiness and the knowledge of compassionate actions. Wisdom of no inherent identity, which we don't have. It's very hard to grasp that, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. That's what makes death fearful, then. Because then you're confronted with
kind of non-existence.
And what all of the, you know, Dumo and all those different practices, what they're trying to get you to see, or when you see, when you have a Tibetan practice where the dissolution of the deity at the end, they're all pointing to the same thing. Everything dissolves into clarity. There's just clarity. And then out of the clarity arises the deity. And it's like, that is happening every moment. But we don't see the death from moment to moment of a self. Do we? But that's happening every moment. So what you're doing when you're practicing that dissolution of a deity is you're practicing how to be conscious of your own death. And maybe how to be conscious of it from moment to moment, if you're really good. But that would take an awful lot of merit and wisdom. So that when everything dissolves into emptiness, isn't that what it says? But there's this, and this is just clear light, usually, clear light. So in the Poa practice, you're asked to imagine the clear light of the void. In the dissolution of the deity, you're asked to become aware of the clear emptiness. Everything dissolves, so it's just clarity. Consciousness without any subject object. Or seeing the screen on which the subject object movies play. Because the subject object movies are always playing. We're always playing them, aren't we? Mm-hmm. When I'm saying, talking now. But what is the consciousness on which it's playing? And to be able to see the consciousness rather than the movie. That's the clear light. That's absolute reality. And you examine the emptiness, the clarity, you examine the clarity, you try to find some quality to it, and what do you find? You're a laundry. You find what? It's empty. Can't find any particular quality to it. And you start exploring the emptiness and you try to find some way of defining it, and it just goes on and on and on. And then you say, well, what's trying to define it? And they say, oh, that's the clarity. And you see a clarity with emptiness, and emptiness with clarity, and clarity with emptiness over and over again. And then at one point, a sudden understanding, non-separation of clarity and emptiness. At that point, then compassion can come in. That's the absolute. Then the compassion can come in and say, out of compassion for all living beings, I will manifest as Kathy Sinclair or Donald, or, you know, and carry on. But now with a different wisdom. Because the life force is still going, so now you've got, you know, something to play with. Now it's like being in a toy shop all the time. Because you know that there is not one person that doesn't have that same quality of the clarity and emptiness dancing in their being, the non-dual nature of clarity and emptiness, everybody. We're already awakened, we just have to discover it. That's the point of Buddhism. It's not something to get. It's to quit getting and see what you got.
It seems to me the practice of loving kindness, for example, gets you to a state that you're more able to see that. Because I've been thinking about this all week, and I haven't been able to articulate it really well, but it's at the core of it. I always come back to practicing loving kindness takes you out of duality and into a boundless kind of cycle of
may all beings be.
And may all beings be able to share that energy as well. So it's like this atomic reaction.
So they're called the boundless energy. States, aren't they?
Yeah.
The four.
Yeah, loving kindness, compassion, joy and equanimity.
They're called the four boundless states.
Yeah.
Because whether you're relative or absolute, those are the easiest boundless states to grasp. You see that in kids when they, you know, when Olivia puts a cookie in your mouth, or a pea. She loves her peas, she's eating a pea. And she looks at you and this love comes over her and she puts the pea in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that feeling, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
You've had that feeling, haven't you? Where like just suddenly somebody just, no difference between you and me, and just touches. We all know that feeling. And it is boundless. Empathy can be traced in the brain. They discovered that if, you know, a tennis player watches somebody playing tennis and he's imagining himself playing it at the same time, the brain goes through all the same activity as if he was moving.
Yeah. Sort of
yeah. They've discovered that if you feel kindly towards someone else, the brain goes through the same activity for both. That there is this movement that transcends self for both. This is really interesting, isn't it? Do you think it's interesting? I think it's very interesting.
What happens to me when I read or I hear you read, there's something in my brain that says, I read it, I should understand it. But I don't understand it. So I get the choice to read it again, try to understand it, or as I've done most of my life, just plow on and hope it's gonna come about. And I was told when reading the Lan Rim, only read a piece of it and read it again and again and again and again and again until you understand it. There's no sense in going on to the next page until you understand the page you're on. And I've been fighting with it because the book is that big. I got to get through the book to understand it. No, I got to go back to that one paragraph or that three words. Or I have to get a Tibetan dictionary to look it up, or I have to get a fucking wagon over to look it up.
Do you enjoy doing that?
Oh, yeah. But it takes so much time.
No, it doesn't.
Well, it how I measure time on my watch.
Yeah, how the resident expert thinks you should be doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not anything to do with how you're doing it.
No. But when I do it, like you say, or like I said, just go over it, understand it. Then when I do understand it, it's great. If I can hold on to that understanding, that's even greater.
Well, you don't try to hold on to it. When there is one moment of understanding, then you trust it's in the depth. And then you go on to the next part. And you wait, and somehow, in the depth, they'll put the different parts together.
But, okay, the different parts come together with the different teachers. I find that.
I know that, too.
When I hear you speak it, I hear Tarchin speak it, I hear Bonnie Ross speak it. You're saying something different.
Yeah, but it's
from the same place.
It's Dharma. That's right.
Then it goes, bang, now I understand what Cecily was saying. I understand what Tarkin was saying.
Exactly.
And then that's the euphoria. That's the euphoria when I go, oh, God, I finally got it.
Yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah. It's...
So it's like not a matter of getting it right, but feeling and understanding. So there's a difference, isn't there? There's a difference between trying to get it right or trying to understand it in some kind of intellectual way,
uh-huh.
or having a sense of what is meant.
But, okay, as an example, a long stretched example, would be like the Buddha hitting enlightenment. It reads the other way. When you get it. But he now transcends. He came back, and he says, "Okay, now how can I teach this to these five disciples?
Mm-hmm.
I now know it. I understand it myself. But now, how can I teach it to the five?
Right.
To the five disciples.
Right. Mm. Interesting, eh?
Yeah. And okay, answering my own question again. When you read a passage and you explain it in three different ways, three different people hearing it in three different ways, which in my brain I'm trying to follow all three ways,
uh-huh,
instead of just grasping onto one,
uh-huh,
not grasping, but
being open
to one and staying with the one, uh-huh, and let the one that resonates the best,
yeah,
rather than trying to follow all three to what you're saying.
Right.
And then it gets really confusing. Then I'm just,
yeah,
then I'm totally lost.
Yeah.
It's taken a long time to put that one into words.
Yeah. But you did.
Only if I talk.
But you do.
I'm doing more now.
Yes, you are.
It's taken a long time.
Yeah.
A long time.
Well, it's a good thing you had the time.
Just throw my watch away.
That's smart. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints so far?
Just a complaint that you say it three times. And then I think I have to follow all.
Did you have something they wanted to?
Just that is. Seeing absolute truth the same as enlightenment?
Yeah. It's the experience of transcendence, they call it. Transcending subject-object duality. And the thing that they all the schools of Buddhism teach is that experience of transcendence is present in everyone all the time. It's not something you get. It's something you've already got. But you're not looking at. That's very interesting, isn't it? So all those practices, like about, you know, because we're so convinced about our view of what we see of being right and wrong. So they have all these practices where you, you know, imagine yourself as a Garuda flying through the air, or, you know, like, okay, now who are you? Or in the Zen tradition, what is the nature of one hand clapping? Ask a question that you can't have an intellectual answer. Ask a question and keep holding that question. That doesn't, it's not possible to have an intellectual answer because intellect is in relationship, isn't it? Isn't it? Our intellect is in relationship,
mm-hmm,
our own experience, therefore I learned this. So you ask a question that cannot have an intellectual answer. And you keep asking it, so that the mind has to let go of the intellect, let go of the relative. All of the different schools, they all are basically to do the same thing. Whether it's imagining yourself with 28 arms and 52 heads, or imagining yourself with asking a question that's so stupid you can't imagine why anybody would want you to ask it, or watching your breath, or any of those things. What on earth could be possibly interesting about sitting there and counting your breath? Eventually, your intellect has to just shut up and you're just actually just in a state of being. All of these are just different ways of practicing how to be present in the moment. which is called transcendence. We have two qualities, knowing and being. Don't we? Developing power with the state of being, and then knowing how to ask a decent question with the knowing, when there is a powerful state of being, not scattered mind. That's the path. But in order to find that path, we have to get past all of our emotional crap, don't we? Have one or two emotional bits of garbage, do you?
Mm-hmm.
Me too.
Couple.
There's a third dimension to the meaning of dependent origination, which is that all things and events, everything in fact, arises solely as a result of the mere coming together of the many factors which makes them up. When you analyze things by mentally breaking them down into the constitutive parts, you come to the understanding that it is simply in dependence upon other factors that anything comes into being. I'm rereading this. Therefore, there is nothing that has any independent or intrinsic identity of its own. Whatever identity we give things is contingent on the interaction between our perception and reality itself. However, this is not to say that things do not exist. Buddhism is not nihilistic. Things do exist, but they do not have an independent, autonomous reality. Let us now refer back to the statement by the Buddha when he said that seeing dependent origination leads to seeing the Dharma, which corresponds to the three different levels of meaning of dependent origination. First, we can relate Dharma to the first level of meaning of dependent origination, which is causal dependence. By developing a deep understanding of the interdependent nature of reality in terms of causal dependence, we are able to appreciate the workings of what we call karma. Action. Depending on this arises. The action. That's what karma means, action. That is the karmic law of cause and effect, which governs human actions. This law explains how experiences of suffering arise as a result of negative actions, thoughts, and behavior, and how desirable experiences such as joy arise as a result of the causes and conditions which correspond to that result, causative actions, emotions, and thoughts. Developing a deep understanding of dependent origination in terms of causal dependence gives you a fundamental insight into the nature of reality. When you realize that everything we experience arises as a result of the interaction and coming together of causes and conditions, your whole view changes. Your perspective on your own inner experiences and the world at large shifts as you begin to see everything in terms of this causal principle. Once you do that, you see, now you're perceiving perception. Not projecting perception. Once you can do that, you're perceiving, you're aware of perception. You're not caught in the perception. You're able to perceive perception.
What's the projecting?
Huh?
What did you mean by projecting?
Subject-object. The cat walked into the room. Subject object. But, you know, what room? There's just a bunch of atoms around here.
What cat?
What thought? And on and on. But perceiving the perception. rather than being caught by it as our reality, the reality. Your perspective on your own inner experiences and the world at large shifts as you begin to see everything in terms of this causal principle. Once you have developed that kind of outlook, you will be able to situate your understanding of karma within that framework. Since karmic laws are a particular instance of this overall general causal principle. Similarly, when you have a deep understanding of the other two dimensions of dependent origination, the dependence of parts and whole, and the interdependence of between perception and existence, your view will deepen. And you will appreciate that there is a disparity between the way things appear to you and the way they actually are. What appears as some kind of autonomous objective reality out there does not really fit with the actual nature of reality. Once we appreciate that fundamental disparity between appearance and reality, we gain insight into the way our emotions work. And how we react to events and objects. Underlying the strong emotional responses we have to situations, we see that there is an assumption that some kind of independently existing reality exists out there. I feel this way about that. In this way, we develop an insight into the various functions of the mind and the different levels of consciousness within us. We also grow to understand that although certain types of mental states seem so real, and although objects appear to be so vivid, in reality they are illusory. They do not really exist in the way we think they do. Reality is a thing. My sister's father was born. She's in the hospital, my sister. She's just recovering from dying. She's actually nice to me. She says she loves me. My nephews ask me, what do you do? And what do you teach? And I decide to tell them the truth. I say, well, the most important teaching I give is the Polish mudra. He says, what's that? Is that Buddhist? I say, oh, yes, right. He says, what is it? And I said, well, I really can only tell you that it can only be bestowed by the third daughter of a Polish father. And my father was Polish, and my sister said, he was German. He was right. It's interesting, isn't it? He was right. Once we appreciate the fundamental disparity between appearance and reality, we gain insight into the way our emotions work. I'm repeating that, right? Is that interesting to you that I repeat?
That's it. That's absolute reality.
The fundamental disparity between appearance and reality. That's not absolute reality. There is no absolute reality. Fundamental disparity, when we become aware of the disparity between appearance and reality, what appears and what we think of as reality. When we can see, perceive our perceptions rather than believing them to be true.
Perhaps I think hearing this expression of what it means, seeing things as they really are.
Yeah.
I don't know what it means.
And it basically is talking about that. Seeing perception when it's perceiving. Not being caught by believing what you're seeing is out there. Being aware of how that sound will trigger an emotion in all of us. Won't it? For some people, it'll remind them of when they had their first lawnmower, and how exciting that was, and all the neighbors came over. For somebody else, it's like, why don't we close the window? Is that true? Is that true? And when you can see why you have that perception, are you relieved when it stopped? Okay, what is that perception about? Why is that perception there? When you can perceive the perception, does that make sense to you now?
Something
else. And that's seeing things as they are, seeing yourself, perceiving. Reality is the thing you think about, thing, R-E-S, thing, think, and reality, all the same root. I know I keep repeating that, but that was what David Bohm said, the physicist who was one of the people who invented the atomic bomb. Great, great, beautiful man. Anyway, should I carry on? Or? Good question, by the way. Underlying the strong emotional responses we have to situations, we see that there is an assumption that some kind of independently existing reality exists out there. We actually project it out there. We don't see ourselves projecting it. Is that true? In this way, we develop an insight into the various functions of the mind and the different levels of consciousness within us. We also grow to understand that although certain types of mental states seem so real, and although objects appear to be so vivid, in reality they are mere illusions. They do not really exist in the way we think they do. It is through this type of reflection and analysis that we will be able to gain an insight into what in technical Buddhist language is called the origin of suffering. In other words, those emotional experiences that lead to confusion and which afflict the mind. When this is combined with an understanding of the interdependent nature of reality at the subtlest level, then we also gain insight into what we call the empty nature of reality, by which we mean the way every object and event arises only as a combination of many factors and has no independent or autonomous existence. Our insight into emptiness will, of course, help us to understand that any ideas that are based on the contrary view, that things exist intrinsically and independently, are misapprehensions. They are misunderstandings of the nature of reality. We realize that they have no valid grounding either in reality or in our own valid experience, whereas the empty nature of reality has a valid grounding, both in logical reasoning and in our experience. Gradually we come to appreciate that it is possible to arrive at a state of knowledge where such misapprehension is eliminated completely. That is cessation. In clear words, Chandrakirti, who wrote it, states that if one can posit emptiness, then one can posit the world of dependent origination. If one can posit that, then one can posit the causal relationship between suffering and its origin. Once one accepts this, then one can also conceive of and accept the possibility that there could be an end to suffering. If one can do that, argues Chandrakirti, then one can also accept that it is possible for individuals to realize and actualize that state. Finally, of course, one can conceive of Buddhas who have actually perfected that state of cessation. The point is that by developing a profound understanding of the principle of dependent origination, we can understand both the truth of the subtle origins of suffering and the truth of cessation. This is the meaning of Buddha's statement that by understanding dependent origination, we see the Dharma. In this way, we can see the truth of cessation and the path that leads to that cessation. Once we understand these, we are able to conceive that it is possible for Sangha members to realize and actualize these states and for Buddhists to perfect them. Finally, we come to some understanding of what Buddhahood really means. That's all I was going to read for tonight. Is that good?
We'll do a little reviewing of it and discussing parts of it more tomorrow. Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? It's a worthwhile book. A simple bath.
Yes, I told you that.
I don't think so. But I've seen it. I think I might have seen the chapters, actually. Is it a new release of this?
It's by Thorsons. It's www.thorsons.com. Mm-hmm. That's who printed it. It was printed in... HarperCollins publishers are the trademarks of that. This edition published in 2002. So it's been around for a while. I've read it once or twice and I just decided that it might be interesting to sort of like, let's just get to the root of what are the Four Noble Truths here, guys. Beautiful book. Besides, there's some really good pictures of his holiness. I like that one too. Shows his double chin. <pretty good. Yeah. laughs>
No caramines.
So I'm going to skip some of the, I think it goes into the Four Noble Truths. I'm going to skip some of the, where he talks about, well, Chandrakirti says this, and, you know, all different schools, and that when we go there, I'm just going to kind of keep it as simple as possible. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, this was fairly simple. Does that sound?
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
It isn't anything we don't know, but it's something we don't like to grasp. Mm. You know, there's a strong attachment to being, you know, subject-object. So we know, then we know who we are.
So what is the best way to start working towards that? Through mindfulness? And
yeah, basically to actually... You know, for me, one of the reasons why I so like the blue flower meditation is because if you do it, you actually see all the different selves. Because the blue flower is so bloody dull and boring that you're sitting there looking at it, and pretty soon you say, oh yeah, I wonder what that TV show was on. All right, which one of these? You know, and you don't get rid of any of them, but you just ask all the mind states to just join you. So that you actually get, so that you can actually begin to understand that there isn't one self, that there's all these different selves that go running through. So the pictures of deities, you see them sometimes with necklaces of skulls, or necklaces of fresh heads. That's like all the different mind states, the 50 different mind states that there are different schools that have different numbers of mind states, but generally speaking, there's 52. That's what they usually call the Chaitasikas, 52. And two of them are perception and feeling. So they are taken out because they're in the five aggregates. So there's the 50 head skulls, which means wisdom, means that the mind states are no longer seen as a self. They're dead. But they're adornment. So they're not useless. You know, it's not that you get rid of something or you push it away. It's that you recognize it as a mind state and it's no longer a fixed identity.
So it becomes a tool then.
Yeah.
And when the compassion, when they're going to be live, then they're the freshly severed heads with, you know, tied to each other by the hair with the blood dripping out of their necks and they're going, right? That's compassion. That's like where the transcendent being is working in the relative world, using the mind states for compassion, for interacting with kindness with others. Because every one of the mind states has a power. The power of hatred is focus. Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Can't you just focus exactly on what you don't like? Right. Don't you just zero right in?
Or just focusing on what you do like. It's foggy.
So like if you can find yourself focusing on something and switch to see what's beautiful about it, you're able to use that focus to examine beauty, which is quite different.
And it's also
quite a lot of people talk to me about how this person, whenever they're talking, they can't stand it because the person keeps telling the same stories. And I say to them, what color are their eyes? And they say to me, I don't care. I mean, you know, I think they're blue. I say, well, how many colors of blue can you see in your eyes? The next time they do that, why don't you just start, you know, rather than focusing on what you dislike about their talking, start looking at their eyes and trying to see, is that kid wrong? Is there some green in your brown eyes or something? And pretty soon you're absolutely interested. And then they start changing their way they're talking to you. But that's beside the point. At least you have a good time. And so it's like taking the hatred and then using it for the wholesome. So that's what those mind states. But you can't do that until you can recognize the mind states. And you can't recognize the mind states so long as you think there's one fixed identity. Like I said, why I like the blue flowers so much. Pussycats need love. Any other questions, answers, comments? Okay. Was this interesting for you? Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing how many people discover that they can actually see the mind states once they've done some of the blue flowers. When they've named them and given them all a cushion and say, hey, let's look at this flower together.
Mm.
How many people will say to me, I could actually see that mind state arising. And I could identify it. Oh yeah, that was worry. They are well. Sit there and meanwhile and just looking. So that you're learning how to perceive perception.
The shock of it is actually recognizing that there are mind states, like in this form.
Well, you watch them dance through all the time, but you just don't put.
But you think that that's, I'm thinking this, I'm, you know.
Yeah, but it's this I, it's a continuous I.
Yeah.
But there isn't a continuous I. Yeah, I was thinking this, wasn't thinking this 1 minute ago, and it won't be 2 minutes from now.
Yeah. The weird thing is, there's
real resistance.
Well, there's real resistance, but there's this sense of I've lost it. I've lost it. There's this sense of gap. I've lost it. What is it? The gaps become bigger. And there's something about getting older. You know, I'm quite concerned and think a lot and contemplate a lot about what is actually the advantage of old age, getting older. There has to be some built in into the process,
being born, being totally, the
way there is, but you have to live in a communal situation for it to really pay off, because like, if your tribe or hunter-gatherers, mm-hmm. then when the woman is going to go out and gather or something, the man is going to go out and hunt, she's going to leave the kids for a little while. You know, she has to be able to put her focus on gathering, mm-hmm. not on going ooh, goo, 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 mm-hmm. or making up stories, or telling stories about fire, or, mm-hmm. And whereas old people, mm-hmm. they can do that really well, but they can't remember how to gather or mm-hmm. how to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's basically, that all of the memories are there, but a lot of them are in the way back in the back dusty shelves, and the librarian forgets where they're put. So like trying to find them, like you wake up in the middle of the night and remember something, you wondered what it was you were gonna say two days ago in the middle of the night, you go, oh,
I was gonna say, oh, but who was I gonna say it to?
But the whole thing about what you do remember is how to interact in a childish way, mm-hmm. and with simple things in the here mm-hmm. and now. So that, that's what one of my social scientist friends told me was the advantage of old age, was that you really were good with children.
Mm-hmm.
You'd look after a whole bunch of them, so it really made the tribe work well, but, we're isolated usually from our grandchildren. We don't live in one home or mm-hmm. we're with a pack of adults, of different ages. We don't have a pack, do we? We don't have a tribe that we share a common ground with.
But what if that process, it's happening anyway? Granted, we don't have the other structures as much as we used to, but the usefulness that the way the pattern of a human life evolves, assuming that you survive a certain number of years, is increasingly larger gaps, increasingly less need for the information on what does an elk look like, what does...
Oh, yeah. You mean talking about the technology, are you?
No, I'm talking about what is actually happening in the organism, in the physical composites that make up this organism.
What do you mean by gap?
That's why I'm saying, why wouldn't you need to know what an elk looks like? I mean, are you talking about how there's a shift in how the world...
Well, there's a shift. Right now? There's a shift. For me, anyway, it seems to be the shift is part of the things that I found I needed to know 10 years ago, I have no use for now.
That's right.
And when I don't have it, if there's no practical use for it, then
that's right.
There is no need to remember it.
Yeah.
And comes from people's names or even directions. Those kinds of things, the names, the labels. Like,
yeah, that's right. And it changes very fast, right?
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet, it's clear that if I am lost, like I don't know what the directions are or whatever, there's still some ability to find, to find my way back to some kind of familiarity.
Right.
And that seems to work not only on the physical level, but on the emotional kind of level, too.
Yeah.
But until you hit that stage in one's life, you don't know that. It's like when you're 30, you don't know that the things that you know now, 20 years from now, are not going to be not going to be important at all.
Yeah.
So
it's very interesting.
It is a very interesting
thing. And I'm basically saying that it was because, grandparents could look after grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had that ability really well. They could teach them things. They could teach them the histories, the lores, the stories about origin, mm-hmm. or how to find certain crops, or right.
Mm-hmm.
so that the information was always passed down from the oldest to the youngest generation.
Right.
And that was a continuous thing. But now there isn't that interaction between the oldest and the youngest generation. Most kids can text by the time they're 3 or 4, can they? Mm-hmm. Can they? Mm-hmm. Young kids now, can they?
I think they can text as soon as they can text.
Hmm?
I think that they will now text as soon as they're physically able to text.
Yeah.
And that will get progressively earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. And they get results from that, so they do it.
Olivia can page through an iPod at 10 months old.
Yeah. So there you go.
Because it's there.
So now what is it that we're going to pass on to them that's mm-hmm. going to be the least bit interesting? Where the alphabet came from? The vowels are mm-hmm. going to be totally left out of the alphabet by the time the kids have kids.
Teach them how to sustain attention.
Yeah.
Attention spans are getting shorter and shorter.
I know. But will they be interested? And that's really interesting, isn't it? I find that really interesting. I find that so interesting.
I've just discovered this year that I taught this stage electrics course this year, and when we were doing the review at the end of the year, it became apparent from we did a review of all the students and the fellow that teaches sewing and costume design thing, but it's costume construction. He said it takes them forever to thread a needle because their eye-hand coordination, fine muscle control, is not there. And he said it used to be. Even 5 years ago, it was there. But now, they don't interact with the physical universe nearly as much as they used to
mm-hmm.
in terms of tools and that sort of thing because they're on their PDFD, computers and such. And then I went, oh, because I'd given my class an assignment for, making some cables up and putting connectors on the ends of them and things, and I thought, oh, well, they'll have to spend 45 minutes, whatever. They weren't finished at the end of the 3-hour class. And the light bulb went on, and I went, okay, I know what I'm going to do next year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give them extended exercises over a long period of time.
Right.
To work exactly on eye-hand motor control, because they don't get it.
Yeah.
But once they've done it...
But brain word
exactly.
Really good, because I'm an eye-hand.
But because of brain plasticity and everything else that you've taught us through the other courses, which I was passing on to them as well
mm-hmm.
in the class. It was more Dharma teaching than anybody's ever done in that theater class. But I know that all I have to do is give them those classes for a few times,
and
your brain cells will grow.
Yeah, I know that too.
Yeah.
But how many people are doing that? And
no.
That's
we have to know that it's missing.
Yeah.
Instead of thinking, oh, they're just lazy or they're not interested, they actually don't have the muscles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't have the skill.
How do you thread a needle?
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you knit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are we done for tonight then?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You notice this extremely gorgeous gold light in your heart. It spreads through your body and tingles up your spine and down to your tailbone and down your legs and out your arms and up your neck and through your head bone. It spreads through this world, right through the room and out through the neighborhood. Just anywhere it goes, it just washes just for a moment. And there's this joy, the birds and the beings in the earth and all the people and all the animals, all the angels. It washes out, so wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind, it's just temporarily as washed. And you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. So thank you for your great compassion. don't forget I have this musical thing for you to listen to.
Yes.
A piece of music that I want you to listen to.
Musical.
Absolutely gorgeous.
And then we have a computer. This is an oral tradition, right?